I'm Teresa, and I'm an adult child.
Hi, Teresa.
It's really nice to be here. Nice to recognize a lot of you. And I didn't think much about what I was going to say. I thought about what I was going to wear, as usual. And I was so happy to find this T-shirt at Burlington Coat Factory today.
Woo!
And because I'm writing a memoir about my life from my childhood, from age 5 till when my dad passed on. It's about my relationship with him. We had incest in our family. And it's called Lion Tamer. So I thought, yeah, this is a perfect T-shirt. Yeah, and I'm going to wear it tonight to ACA. And then I found out, as I'm cutting the tags off, it's just the Nan Klein logo. Oh, man. That's all right. I figured nobody's really going to know, hardly. There aren't that many people that wear Anne Klein clothes, I don't think. Anyway, let's see. So I was born in Seattle, 6 of 10 children, big Catholic family. My dad converted to Catholicism after his 3rd child was born, so he was very staunch Catholic. We prayed the rosary every night. We went to Catholic schools. Every room in the house had a crucifix. We were just, it was in our pores, Catholicism. So I knew what life was about because it was told to me exactly, you know, how it works. And I didn't really have a lot of questions about it until I got older. But let's see. I got into ACA at my first meeting around 1985. And I went to a couple of meetings then. I got sober in 87, and then I stayed sober from 89 till now. And didn't really, it was probably when I was about, just before I got sober in 87, my sister went to a therapist who said, well, you've been molested. And none of us thought we'd been molested. Our dad had fondled our breasts all our life. He wasn't safe to be around, but we never thought that was being molested. And she gave me this little book, this little pink book called Affirmations for the Inner Child. And I opened it up and I thought, this is sick. And I slammed it shut and shelved it away. I thought, that is bullshit. Affirmations for the inner freaking child. So 2 years later, I'm leaving that marriage that I was in for 14 years that I should have left after year one, because at year one, he said to me, I told you I don't like to talk about inner life things. I'm like, wow, I guess I could either leave him or talk to my sister. So I thought I'll talk to my sister. And well, 14 years after later, I left him. Found that book, and I thought, oh my God, I need this. I need it so bad. And I carried it around, read it about 8 times a day. And so that was my first real introduction to inner child work, and it was like, it just saved me. And then I joined, then I ended up going to therapy. And discovering, yeah, in fact, I had been molested, and it had profoundly affected me. And not only that, he was a very authoritarian person, our dad. So it was crazy making living with him. You couldn't have real conversations. He always knew exactly what the answers were to anything. And he was very moody. So he could be a lot of fun and make you laugh, and then just switch. Turn on a dime. You could just say the wrong thing and then he wouldn't speak to you and off he would go. So we confronted him. Oh, not him. We confronted our mother. We went to our mother to complain about him. A couple of my sisters and I, when I was about 16 years old, and we told her, you know, what he would do. Just he would slip his arm around us and always be handling our breasts. And it was horrible to tell her this. It was so painful because it felt like she's going to break. And I didn't want to put that on her, but we just figured, well, we got to tell somebody, you know. So why not Mom? Yeah. So she basically said, no, that's not possible. He doesn't do that. And we said, well, yeah, he does. It's true, you know. Until now, that can't be. So we said, no, it's really true, Mom, honest. And she goes, well, I guess you better talk to your father then. So we said, oh, all right. You know, like, that's never going to happen. We just went away, kind of gloomy. But I remember thinking it through at the time and realizing that she was afraid of something big if he was confronted. And I think it wasn't till later that I figured it out. She hadn't worked a job. She was a stay-at-home mom of 10 kids all her life. He would have left if she would have put her foot down. And we would have gone into foster care. Now, that would have been that for those days. So, that was 50 years ago. So then I started drinking around then. I remember 16th birthday, that we had a tradition, at least I remember it in our family. I've talked to my siblings since then about the tradition where when you're 16, you get to get drunk and to learn your limits. None of my siblings remember this, but anyways, I got to do it, did it. And that night, I had anxiety, of course, by then. I was riddled with anxiety. I had been sniffing paint thinner when I was 10, when we were painting our house to get ready to move, and smoking pot by 16 and taking swigs, but boy, did it feel good to get drunk. But that night, I don't remember if anything happened. I know my dad was drinking with me. Mom said, well, you know, look after her. But I remember wanting my head to come off. And I had started headbanging earlier, like probably a year or two earlier, because I would get so anxious. And just, I learned that, well, if I crack my head on something, it calms me down. So we had a brick post out front of the house, or a door jam would work really good. And I remember that night I got drunk. I just wanted my head to fly off, and I thought, oh, I'll run headlong into the wall. That'll kill this pain. And I did. I was excited. I thought, this is a brilliant idea. And I did. I just ran straight into the wall and crashed with my head first and fell over laughing. And my dad saw it happen, and he started laughing. And I said, I'm going to do that again because it felt good. And I got up and I went back down the hall and I charged again. And I'm not sure if I hit it the second time or not. I was pretty drunk. Or if it took the third time before he caught me in midair. And my mom said, Herb, stop her, you know. But I didn't have any insight in those days that there was something wrong. In fact, I remember panhandling drunk and barefoot in the rain in Contra Costa County when I was about 25. And not really having an idea that there was something wrong with my life. You know, there was no food in the apartment that we were just kind of squatting in because the friends we were with had gotten evicted and whatever. And the boyfriend was alcoholic like I was. The neighbors were giving us booze, but anyways, I was just kind of rolling forward in my life, just letting it play out. And this woman comes out of the store, and in those days, if you got a dime, that was pretty good. Nickel was like, nah, but a dime is okay. A quarter was a lot of money. So that's like 40 years ago. So she passes me up with her little children. She's got kind of frumpy clothes on. She leaves her kids with a cart and comes back. And she emptied her coin purse into my palm. It was like 83 cents or something like that. And she just looked me in the eye with compassion. And then she, you know, left. And I remember I just went up against the building and cried. It was like the first time I had an inkling that maybe there's something wrong with my life. Like, I was so just lost, just floating, just kind of bobbing along. No sense of that I might have choices or I could choose values or I matter. So, and I think that was a defense mechanism. If I just don't matter, then I can't really get hurt. And that's how my life was playing out. So I got beat up by that boyfriend and got out of jail the next morning because we were both smashed, and I told him I needed to go to the hospital, and we got stopped on the way by the cops. And the nurse flashed a light in my eye and said, "She's fine." And in the morning, I get out of jail and I apologize to him because I had made him mad, telling him I didn't want him to go drink without me. So, you know, that's how we are, right? We just really don't know that we matter until something happens. And for me, it was the beginning of me beginning to matter, really was that woman dumping her change in my hand. I didn't get sober then, I didn't get to ACA, but something shifted inside of me. And it wasn't too long after that that the boyfriend was hooking up with somebody else, and I said, "Well, I'm done with you," and off I go to live in an empty room in this friend's place. And I thought, something's wrong with my life. And so now the light's going on, something's wrong. And I thought, well, I had no idea what to do. I thought, I'm not crazy, so I can't go down to the county building like the people I was hanging out with did. So I just started sweeping this big empty flat that was on the railroad tracks, because I thought, this is what monks do. They sweep. And they're calm. I needed to get calm. And there was a rosemary bush outside, and I thought, and people that drink tea, they get calm. So I made rosemary tea and swept dust bunnies. And that was like my first recovery efforts, my first acting on behalf of myself, like to try to help myself. And then I called my first husband and said, "You want to get back together?" And he goes, "Yeah." One day, and about 2 days later, there I was. I arrived, and he was drunk with my brother, who was drunk. They picked me up from the train station. And so that, you know, lasted for about 6 months. And I signed up for a physics class, and that was like another, like, yeah, if I take a physics class and an art class, that'll help. So I was taking these actions on my own behalf, and they were helping. Every little bit helped. And then finally, well, I ended up sleeping around, and I thought, I need to quit chasing men. I'll go to the library in the morning instead of the bar at night. And I saw a guy at the library. I liked his smile, and I chased him down the aisle and ended up with him for 14 years. That was the guy, you know, that didn't like to talk. He just had a really good smile. Nice man, but not a fit for me. So, so after I left him, well, I got sober 4 years before I left him, and getting sober helped a lot, obviously. And I went to Survivors of Incest Anonymous at the time. That was shortly before I left him, I believe. I started going to SIA. And I ended up with another guy, and then he kept dropping me, and I kept going back, and I got suicidal because he would kept dropping me. And I kept telling my sister everything he did wrong. One day, and she loved to listen, but except one day she says, "Teresa, the answers are within you." And it was like, oh, man, it was like a kick in the gut, because I wanted to just talk about it, how bad it was and everything, the drama. But it was what I needed to hear, because that was how I got in touch with my insides, my truth. And the truth was, I needed to leave. And in about 6 months, I left. So all these experiences kept taking me in to myself. So I left that guy, and in the process went back to SIA, and there met my Charles, my present husband, I won't break his anonymity or anything. And we went out for coffee after an SIA meeting one night. I always used to just hurry home. I was too scared, too shy of people. But one night he says, yeah, Teresa's coming with us. And I thought, oh, all right, I'll go. And there was a little band of six of us militant SIA folks. And the others went out to smoke after we'd had our coffee. And Charles and I said, we'll clear the table. So I said to Charles, you take the cups, I'll take the saucers. And he just shot me a look like, what? And I'm like, or I'll take the cups, you take the saucers. And then he just grinned. He says, well, as long as we're doing it together. And that was kind of like maybe the date, you could say, that we started to connect from. And that was 22 years ago. And we're still married. We got married after that, a little while. And I'm telling you, it's like night and day being married. When I went to AA, when I was new, I saw a gal on stage say, yeah, and my life is so good and 7 years of recovery and I've got a partner, I've got a husband who rolls up his sleeves and does life with me. And I thought, I'm going to have that. Only it's not going to take me 7 years to get it. It was 4 years, but I got it. It's a whole different ballgame to have a partner that rolls up their sleeves and does life with you, you know. I don't need to tell some of you that, but I want to mention that just as encouragement to others who might not yet have found someone like that. And not to say we haven't had our issues and troubles and squabbles and everything, but when the bottom line, when recovery is at play, things work out. And coming into that place of, you know, really relying on a higher power. You know, we were at the brink one time. It looked like we were just going to have to split up because all our efforts were failing. And he says, well, let's pray. So we prayed. And then we prayed every day from then on. All three prayers. The serenity prayer, the third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer. for a long time, and somehow things worked out. I couldn't tell you how, they just did, and I'll tell you, it was probably our higher power that stepped in, that kind of soothed our souls, that let us know that, hey, it doesn't all matter. You can let a lot of things go. It's okay to relax, etc. And so it's worked out ever since. So around, 2016, my mom passed away in, I think, 2007. Yeah, my dad in 2010. So, you know, I've always been a writer. I've loved to write about my life. And I started writing about my childhood about, probably, 15 years ago. And, but I never could really do it, you know. I would get a chapter or two and I'd have to stop because I feel like so guilty telling the story and making my dad and my mom look bad. But I kept trying over and over again, and finally I realized, you know, I can't do it while they're alive. And they were approaching 90, you know, and I thought, just put it away. They'll pass on and then you can write it. And basically, that's what I did. And in the process of their getting into their 90s, my mom got dementia and then she passed on. And to my dismay, I wanted my dad to go first. But there we were, left with dad, no buffer between us. And most of my siblings didn't want anything to do with him. And that kind of left me because I loved him. I never stopped loving him. And it was hard, but I thought, you know what? Principles before personalities. Love and tolerance is our code. He's a precious child of God, too. He's a sick man. Treat him like a newcomer. All of that I got from program served me. And so I'd go see him in the nursing home. And I'd sit in my car and pray first. Then I'd go in But I always left feeling so good, so glad that I did it. And in the process, you know, I got more confident. And one day, though, I was, and he would be inappropriate. He would say, what are you wearing under that blouse? Or, you know, just, and just, he would switch and become like this person I couldn't bear to be with. But I would just freeze. I didn't know what to do. I would just like change the subject or whatever. One day I'm driving down the freeway and this semi truck is on my right, and I'm getting progressively, I noticed for a month, getting more panicky driving. And then I was almost in a full blown panic attack on the freeway. And I'm like, this is not going to work. What's going on? And all of a sudden I realized it's my dad. The semi is my dad. My fear was that the semi could just come into me anytime. And I thought, I've never been afraid of passing semi-trucks. And here I was convinced a semi-truck, every time I passed one, that it was going to barrel into me. And I thought, you need to stand up to Dad. That's what's going on. So the next time he was inappropriate, I did. I just said, you got to do it. I said, Dad, that is not okay. I'm your daughter. I got to go. And he got pissed. Oh, well, I don't remember what he said. He was like, he was just angry. Well, then go then, you know, raised his voice and everything, you know, and I'm like, I am. And out I went. And I tell you, I was so angry. And my whole life, I had never been angry with my dad, ever. Not once. And I think it's because he would rage at two-year-olds. I'd seen him do that as an adult. And I had a sense he did it when I was little. And that is it. I thought he would kill me. I mean, not intellectually, in every cell in my being, I thought, he'll kill me if I'm mad at him. Because he's huge, and he would just, his roar was so loud. So I went to my car just happy that I was so angry. I said, I'm mad at Dad. And the next day I was still mad. The next day I was still mad. And I thought, well, that's probably long enough to be mad at Dad. Because, you know, he's alone in the nursing home. And I thought, I can go back now, because now I know how to stand up to him. And my sisters came one time and visited him, and he said something, and I said, Dad, that's not okay. I'm angry, or something like that. And they just looked at me like, you what? I said, oh, yeah, I tell him anytime now. Because none of them had ever stood up to him before, because of the same thing. It's like conditioning. So emboldened, you know, I said to him, I said, you know, Dad, your kids would come and see you if you would just acknowledge that you did something wrong. How come you've never apologized to anybody? And there was a kind of a trust that kind of developed. He thought about it for a while, and he finally says, you know, pride, a mountain of it. I drag it around with me everywhere I go. And was like, wow, it was like the first thing he'd ever said that even sort of acknowledged that maybe he had hurt people. So then, you know, one night I'm there and I said, you know what, why don't we write letters to, you know, your kids? Why don't you write letters? I got some paper and I brought it, and you can just write a little note apologizing. I said, would that be okay? He said, yeah, okay. But now he's getting more and more senile. And I said, all right. I said, you want to start with Sue? Oh, no, not Sue. It was like he was a little child, scared to write a note to his oldest daughter, you know. And so he tried another one, and he just couldn't. I thought, you know, if you just keep at it, you're just badgering him, and he's not capable. So then I go out there one time to see him, like, you know, maybe a week or two later, I forget, but... And there he is in the dining room all by himself, because he would go around in his wheelchair. And he was like bent way over under the table. And I went over there and I said, hi, Dad, what are you doing? He goes, oh, hi. I'm just trying to find the, you know, he couldn't really articulate what he was looking for. He's reaching deep in under the table for something, you know. And I said, well, what is it? And he says, he goes, they should never have taken it from me. And I said, what? And he says, my dolly. And I said, your dolly? He said, oh, yeah. Yeah. Come on, Herbie. come on, you know, this is the night. This is the night. We have to take her. He was like 4 years old. He plays the story. He's playing it out. And then he just burst into tears. Just wailed like a child. And he had told my sister and I, like, I don't know, maybe a month before, we were trying to figure out what went wrong in his childhood. So we said, let's all share what was our favorite toy. As a kid, I said, oh, mine was my blue dog with stripes, and Sheila's was a doll. And my dad says, oh, my dolly. She had a purple gown and a lace collar, and her hair was done up in a bun. He described this dolly. I said, oh, was that your sister's? He goes, oh, no, that was mine. It was like, wow. So he said, let's share our favorite games. What was your favorite game? Catching mice and killing them. He says, okay, Dad. Yeah. So his parents used Lysol for birth control. And I've speculated, you know, like, it's not, you know, they used it every time they did it. So my guess is my poor dad got a dose of Lysol or some freaking thing. But I think he was sick. He wasn't all of a piece, I think. He did the best he could with what he had. So I came to see that. And when he finally passed on, the day he passed on, I was singing this song. I've been loving you a little too long to stop now. When you hold me in your arms, can't help feeling everything's fine. I've been loving you a little too long to stop now. And somebody says, look, and he had opened his eyes. He'd been like in a coma for 3 days. And he had opened his eyes and he mouthed, and it totally, like, you know, healed me. Before those days in the nursing home, well, when he was there, but maybe before I got mad at him or around that time, I was taking classes, addiction classes, and we were studying group therapy. So I was supposed to, it was my turn to have somebody in the empty chair and, you know, tell them how I felt. And I said, okay, I'll put my dad there. So she said, okay, tell him how you feel. And I said, you know, Dad, you really hurt me. You know, you touched my breast. You shamed me. I was lost. I didn't have any security or sense of self. It really hurt. And she says, what's he saying to you? And I said, well, he's calling me a slut and a whore. That's what he did. We did confront him. I forgot to say that part. And he just called us all sluts and whores, and it never happened. So the teacher goes, oh, well. And I said, well, let me try it this way. I'll put him in the chair after he's dead. He's in a nursing home right now, but I'll pretend he's already passed on. Dad, you really hurt me, you know, touching me like that. You know, it affected me profoundly, and it wasn't all right with me. What's he saying now? He's saying, I'm so proud of you for confronting me. I couldn't have done it differently. I did the best I could, and I'm just so proud of you. It was like I could see that from his highest self, that would be exactly what he would want to say to me. I had that deep understanding that he always loved me, and he behaved badly. So is my time about 4? Thanks. Okay, so then, so he passed on, and I'm like, yes, now I can write my memoir, Lion Tamer. I can write the whole thing, and I sit down and I start like, gosh, where do I start? You know, it was like having this whole buffet, and I could have whatever I wanted. I couldn't get started. You know, I would start it here. No, that's not good. Start there. No, okay, structure it. No, that's not working. Well, just write. And then all of a sudden, the censors started up in my brain, you know. You can't say that. You can't write that in a book. And all of a sudden, I just slammed my computer shut. I was so angry. And I said, I have to go to ACA. Because I had gone a little bit here and there, but I had never worked the steps. Charles, meanwhile, was deeply involved working the steps. So I went to ACA, got in a step study group, and within a month, I'm just clicking away, writing my book. And now volume one is all but done. It's been revised like 4 times. It's going to go off to an editor in about 2 weeks. And then I've got volume two half done and three half done. And my life is just a fucking freaking blessing. And you guys never heard that before, right? And thank you. Thanks to all of you, because, you know, I couldn't have done it without going to ACA and living with an ACA-er who is like living at an ACA meeting all the time. So I feel guilty that I haven't been to a lot of meetings lately, but I kind of live at an ACA meeting. We journal every morning and we share what we write. It's really, really helpful. And that's all I'll share. I love you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.